Good morning, all. I'm very excited to be here and speak to you. You may not be so excited after what I have to say. I'd like to start by reading the word. So if you are able and if you are willing, can you please stand and join me in reading what we are going to be looking at today? And this is in Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 48. So the same Sermon on the Mount that we've been in. Next section. Retaliation. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him for 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Love your enemies. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect, as your heavenly Father is perfect. You can take a seat. I'm going to just pray before I continue. God, thank you for these words. I pray that our hearts and minds would be open today to hear what you have to say, and I pray that you would give me the words that you want people to hear today, God. I know that these are hard truths, God, and so I pray for understanding. I pray for where we have misunderstood these words that you would correct our minds with truth. And where we need to be convicted, we would feel that and act upon it. And where healing needs to happen for these moments, that would occur too. Pray that you would just bless us as we learn together today. In your name, amen. So, I am a sixth grade teacher, so some of my jokes may go under your heads as opposed to over them. But whenever I teach, I like to recap a little of what happened the last day to make sure we actually were listening and paying attention to what we were learning. So I just want to go over what have we actually been learning about the past few weeks. And we started out with live the blessed life, right? Okay, we talked about what are the Beatitudes. It is an attitude of how we are supposed to live in order for our lives to look a little bit more like Christ, right? The Beatitudes are be poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn, who are meek, right? That you see your spiritual need for God, that you are mourning your loss of not having him within in your life, and then that you humble yourself under him. And then it says, blessed are those who thirst and hunger for righteousness, who practice mercy, whose hearts are pure, who seek peace. So once you have come and put yourself in humility under him, are you now living like him? And then we come to the end of the list where it talks about persecution. We haven't covered that yet, so we'll get to it. Then he says, be salt and light. Why are we doing what we're doing? So that others will No. Then he talks about the law. I'm not here to say, don't do that. I'm here to say, yes. And also, it's not the letter of the law, it's the spirit of the law. Why is it here? And my authority is to fulfill these things. Let me show you exactly how to do that in each of these instances. So then he continues to give examples of, yes, I told you this is how you need to live, but I'm going to give you examples as to what this actually looks like, because I know otherwise you're going to be like, you didn't really mean it that way. So then he says, check yourself. Where is your anger? Where is your heart at? Where is your emotions at? And referring to lust and different things. And in those instances, you need to reconcile as much as you can. That's brought up over and over again. And then the last two are about divorce, and one that we didn't cover was about oaths. And what he is saying, yes, do all of these things. And also, if you are making promises or covenants, like the covenants that I made to you, you too need to keep those. Be a person of integrity, be a person of your word. And the caveat on all of those is, regardless of others' actions. Whenever B comes up to me and goes, Rose hit me. This is a constant thing in our household. I turned to her and I said, what did you do? Because it's usually in response, right, that we do it. And if I go to Rose and I say, did you hit her? Rose will usually say, yes, but I didn't ask what she did to you. I asked what your response to the situation was. And I think that that is often what God is talking. He says, yes, people may treat you in a certain way, but I didn't ask you how others were treating you. The whole first part of it is about what are you choosing to do? What is your response in this situation? Okay. So sometimes we're like, well, I did do the things. I did what I was meant to do. I checked my heart. I looked into different things, and now I'm still in a place where people are mistreating me. So when Jesus gets to, well, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven, they're like, okay, finally, we're talking about other people and not us. Good, it's taken off of me. That is not the case, unfortunately. He addresses that if you are living in this way, you shouldn't be surprised if people begin to oppose you. In fact, you should expect it. If you are truly doing this in the way that you should, you will face opposition and be mistreated. So because I know that's going to happen to you, because you're going to follow these things, how do we actually respond when true mistreatment occurs? Okay. Six times in this passage, Jesus starts out with, you have heard that it was said, which is an interesting and a cool phrase, because this is all about the law and him fulfilling the law, saying, here's the old law, here's my new covenant, here's how we live that law out in the commandment. Okay? And so any of the laws that he's quoting, the Jewish people, anyone listening would have been very intimately aware of what he was talking about. They would have known those rules. Those rules would have been knocked into their heads many a times. It was the law that you lived, that you followed. We knew all the way from way back that this is how God had ordained things. So I wanted to take a deeper dive into, well, who is he quoting, right? Because if Jesus is quoting something, there must be something to that. So he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I think this is so often misunderstood. In my mind, it sticks out in Fiddler on the Roof. They're talking about how do we get even with the Russian people. And one of the people is like, well, the Bible says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And the rabbi responds, very good. Then the whole earth will be blind and toothless. And I look at it and I go, that's such a weird rule for him to quote. Where did that come from? Well, it comes out of Exodus and Leviticus. And it is quoted and it's in there, but that's not actually the first place where it was written down. So I'm a bit of a historical geek here because I teach, I'm teaching social studies, and we've been doing a lot with the four river civilizations of ancient Mesopotamia and Greece history and that kind of thing. Right, Haley? Students here. Yeah, it's fun. Okay, it's fun, right? So actually, the first time that this commandment was given was 500 years before the Levitical books and the Ten Commandments were written. And it was written down in a code called Hammurabi's Code. Okay, so who's Hammurabi? Hammurabi, or Hammurapi, either way, there's a couple of different ways of referring to him. But Hammurabi was an Assyrian king of old. And when things started out in Mesopotamia, everyone was kind of like split up into their own little kingdoms in different places. And Hammurabi became this great warrior who conquered and brought the nations together, like one of the first like main kings that was there in Mesopotamia. And there's some like scholarly debate, was Abraham alive during this time? And many scholars think yes, and many think no. But it does line up with a lot of biblical understanding that we have of like the different nations moving around. So Hammurabi becomes king, and he notices, like, I need to have some sort of code of justice. And up to this point, law was never really written down. Like, it was like, over here in this town, this is what we say, but there wasn't something to refer back to say, it is written, so it is said, right? And so Hammurabi, you can't really see this, but it's a huge, giant pillar, and on the pillar are like lines and lines of script of all of these rules that he came up with. And when you went forward for judgment, he would have this near him and you would go up to where his throne was and he and his advisors would be like, well, what is the rule? And like, look at it. And they thought like it was given to him because he was like part God. And so therefore he was able to judge and those kind of things. But what it ended up being was this standard of this is the way that we treat other people. Okay, so Hammurabi's code says specifically an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That's where it was first written down. So I was like, is Jesus quoting Hammurabi? And that'd be really weird. And also, why is that in Leviticus? Is God taking law from the Gentile people? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Well, it was common for everyone, like everyone in that time period would have known Hammurabi and would have known that that was one of the rules. And we look at that and we go, oh my goodness, there is so much violence there to say, I take out your eye, you take out my eye, I take out your tooth and you take out my tooth. But actually what it was, is it was a line drawn in the sand for retaliation to say you may only take up to this point, because what was happening is you take on my eye, I kill you, right? And they were saying, that's not fair. That is not fair. So we need to say it needs to be equal. Whatever you do to one person, you'll have done back to you. There is an end to the retaliation. And a lot of the commentaries that I had read talked about, right, our human heart is evil. And we talk about getting even, but what we really mean is getting ahead, making it feel right for us. And so that law there, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, was not about continuing violence. It was saying, there is an end. You may not go any farther than this in any sort of justice that you are seeking. That's it. Now, we still go, okay, but it's in Levitical law. Like, what is the difference? The difference is Hammurabi's code, eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, did not span social classes. His was only for the rich. If you were poor, if you were a woman, if you were a slave, if you were anything else, this didn't apply to you. People could still do what they wanted to you. But in Levitical law, the spirit of the law behind it is life is sacred. And not just any, like, not just high society life, every life. Because behind that Levitical law is listed, who does this apply to? It applies to women. It applies to slaves. It applies to unborn children. It applies to the foreigners living in your land. And so by stating that and God taking the law that was being twisted, right, that had been put on human hearts, right? We as humans have that more moral understanding that human life is sacred. It had been twisted with Hammurabi's code. He took it and said, no, this is what I mean. All life is sacred. Not one more than another. There is an end to it. No matter why the thing has been done, there is a line of justice, and that justice is for anyone living within my covenant. So it already was countercultural. But the issue was that the people of the time that Jesus was talking to would then use that right to say, you poked out my eye. Well, the law says I can poke out your eye. Now, just because the law says you should do it doesn't mean you should go poke out someone's eye. And that's what he is referring to. So the way that Jesus twists this is, but I tell you, do not resist the one who is evil. I struggle with that. I'm like, is Jesus saying be a pacifist? Is he saying let abuse happen? Is he saying the best way to be salt and light is to be a doormat? No. No. We're just going to put it right out there, right now. When you look into the original language, the word resist that is used there is actually one that talks about nonviolent resistance. So he's not saying don't resist the thing that is occurring to you. He's saying, can you think of a way that's not violent to stand up for your rights? Does it have to be an eye for an eye? Is there a different way that you can seek justice that does not continue this cycle of retaliation? So he says, but I tell you, do not resist the one who is evil. Okay. So what does he mean by this? Oh, I have a side note. Okay, just some distinctions and clarifications. This is not about abuse. This is not about injustice, this part of it. Okay. What he is talking about is personal insults that have been done to you. He's talking about relationships. He's still talking about the things that were talked about in the sermon above in how to live in community with others, right? We're not at the persecution part yet. This is just the, if you have been wronged and you feel like someone has done something that is worthy of injustice, it feels like an injustice to you personally, how do you deal with it? Okay, so now that's clarified. All right, so Jesus actually comes up with four examples of what does it look like to have non-violent resistance when something is done to you. And if we look at those, we might be like really confused because the first one is violent resistance. And then like, well, it's not violent resistance. It's about violence and it's about not being violent back. And you're like, oh, it still doesn't feel very good. Okay. Context is it very clearly says, if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn and give them the left. Okay, now the word right in there is super important to contextual keys, okay? The left hand in their culture, can you come up here, Mitch? The left hand in their culture was used to clean yourself after going to the bathroom because you don't have toilet paper. Right? So you'd use your hand. And this is still done in many Middle Eastern cultures today. And so to touch or to do anything to anyone using your left hand was an absolute disgrace to yourself. It wouldn't even be a disgrace to the other person. It was like, you barbarian, you don't know. And like, it was a horrible thing to do. It would call disgrace upon yourself. So if you're going to slap someone on the right cheek, okay, I'm not actually going to slap Mitch. I'm just going to. Our marriage is great. Okay. Now, the other thing that was used in culture is that a front-handed slap meant something different than a backhanded slap. If you use your backhanded slap, you're saying to someone, you are less than me and you are worthless. It's a snub akin to like the middle finger that you're giving to someone that. That's like kind of where it's at. It would be snubbing someone. If you slap someone with an open hand and a right cheek, like it's like, hey, it's treating someone as an equal. Okay. So children and dogs and people that you wanted to disgrace, you would slap with the back of your right hand. Okay. So if you're going for, okay, all right. If I am a Jewish person, and I'm going to snub another one with a slap, I'm going to use the back hand of my right hand on his right cheek. And it would hit here. Okay. Now, Mitch has one of two. Well, he has a couple of options. He could slap back. But what Jesus says is turn your left cheek. Okay. Now, I, as the aggressor, have a couple of decisions to make. And Mitch isn't like, come on, give it to me. It's just a, okay, like, here it is. I can slap him with an open palm, which then means I'm treating him as an equal, and I'm no longer snubbing him. And that changes the way I have to look at him, in that I am literally calling him my equal. And it's a big thing to slap your equal. It was double the fine in those days if you would do that, like slapping an equal. Or I have to slap him with my left hand, which disgraces me completely. So then I'm left with, I have no options and I have to walk away. And the person I was trying to humiliate has gained the power and love by simply saying, you can't take my dignity away from me. Okay. So we aren't talking about slaps. We're talking about how do you challenge someone and keep your dignity and challenge them in a way that causes them to see you as an equal and to think about their actions. The second one that he says is, if someone sues you for your tunic, give them your coat as well. Okay, so context. The tunic was the undergarment that was worn and the coat was the overgarment that was worn. And it was against Levitical law to take someone's coat and keep it for more than a night, because that was the thing, like the right that everyone was afforded to, that would keep them warm, that would keep them safe. So you could take someone's tunic from them, but you could not take their coat. You can't sue them for their coat. And so a coat was really important too. It was your protection, but also it was always a sign of status. Depending on what your coat looked like, a lot of people would know who you were by what you were wearing. Versace. So it was a designation as to who you were. So what Jesus is saying in here is, if someone is saying, I'm going to take that thing from you, and you say, well, take my coat as well, because clearly you are suffering and you need it more than me. He's not saying to go into complete poverty for yourself, but he's saying, what does extreme generosity look like? How would it change things if someone was like, I need that thing, please give that to me, and you said, great, and here's something else, let me bless you with more. Another way to look at this too is, if you were suing each other, and it was probably within the Jewish context that a lot of this would occur, right? That's your brother that you're suing and taking something from. And sometimes my two girls, poor things, they always get used as objective lessons, will be fighting over a toy. And my question to them is always, what's more important, the thing or your relationship? You may have rights to owning your thing, but if it is causing the relationship to fall apart, that's the first thing you need to look at. If material items are getting in the way of relationship, if they are causing mistreatment because of that, we need to take a step back and say, is the thing I'm fighting over really worth the fight? Or is this relationship between us the greater thing that needs to be won? All right. Then Jesus brings out a big one. If someone forces you to walk 1 mile, walk with them too. And I think a lot of people think of this when they're like, oh, walk a mile in someone's shoes. This is not what that is talking about. Okay. So up to this point, the people are all like, yeah, I can do this in my Jewish community. Yeah, totally. That makes sense. Like, they're my brothers and we can do this. This was referring to a specific Roman law. So the Jewish people living under Roman oppression right now, all of their taxes are going to pay for an army that is continuing to oppress them, right? And so you have Roman soldiers walking all over the place, and the Roman soldiers would often be carrying their packs or whatever they were doing with them wherever they were marching or going to a new place. One of the rules of the day was that a Roman soldier could go to any man or person, no matter what they were in the middle of doing, and say, you must carry my load for a mile with me because I'm tired. So I need you to take my load for me. It didn't matter if you were going in the other direction. It didn't matter if you had something important to do. It didn't matter if you were sickly or weak. That is what the law was that you had to follow that soldier and walk the one, no, I'm not going to give that because I don't know 100, the 1 mile, Roman mile, okay, along with them. And Jesus is saying, can you imagine if you walked that 1 mile and then turned to them and said, let me walk another with you. Just like the slap on the cheek, it takes it from, I'm forcing you to do this, to, I'm willing to do this. It removes all the power of the aggressor without any physical violence. Because what are you going to be? No, you can't carry my pack. Like, you're not going to do that. It's going to change the way that you look at the person. It requires you to see the person that you're forcing to carry your burden as another human being because they have offered love in the place of hate. We can, of course, take this farther, too, and think about, well, what about spiritual burdens that we have within the church? Is someone asking you to carry something? Can you carry it for longer than what they are asking for? If that would show love. The last example that Jesus gives in this section is, if someone begs you for something, give to them. In Jewish culture, if you owed money, think like the prodigal son, right? When he had no money and had to come running back to his father. It was an extremely shameful thing to not be able to take care of your money or your funds. It was a disgrace to have to ask for money. So I think for a lot of us, if our enemy was in a place of not doing well, sometimes our human inclination is go, well, that's God's judgment on you. Looks like you got what you deserved. But if someone is willing to humble themselves enough to come to you and say, I know that things haven't always worked out in the past, but I really need help. The last thing you should do is turn them away when you have an opportunity to show them overwhelming grace and mercy. Don't stand there in judgment. What might giving someone a chance of grace do? How might that be salt and light in their life? Whew. That was a tough lesson. But then Jesus isn't done. He continues. Let me just be clear, all Jewish people who are listening. You think I might just be returning talking about friends, people that you love. I am not. This doesn't just refer to the people that you love. But you have heard that it was said, love your neighbor, but hate your enemies. Okay. Up to this point, Jewish people were often told, right, remove yourself from those around you. In order to be holy, you must be distinct. We must cut off the foreigner. We must, right? That was all in the Levitical law. And now Jesus is saying, but to fulfill the law and the prophets, we're now going to invite even more people in. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor, but hate your enemies. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those that persecute you so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. This is brand new. Again, living in Roman culture and hearing this, love your enemies. Love your enemies. That is absolutely countercultural. We have been taught within our Jewish community that we need to hate anyone that is outside of God. And here Jesus is saying, no, now you need to love them. In this new kingdom era, it's not about forcing people out. It's about drawing people in. We may ask ourselves, who is my enemy? Just like who is my neighbor? very similar answer. Anyone. Anyone that you feel like you have an offense to, a negative feeling towards, you don't get along with, anyone. That can be your neighbor. That can be a friend. That can be a family member. That can be someone on the opposite side of the political spectrum of you, whether it's in person or online. That can be someone that doesn't agree with you religiously. That can be a national leader. That can be your government. Anyone. We're still talking about personal offense. So he's talking about if you're persecuted, right? This is how you need to respond. And I think a lot of times we think things that are persecution that are actually personal offense or perhaps political offense. Persecution that we're going to talk about refers to actually being mistreated because you are being salt and light. If it is for what you believe in and because you are living it out fully, then it is persecution. If it is because you are offended or something feels uncomfortable, that's not persecution. And when we call things persecution that are not persecution, we cheapen the ministry of those who are actually suffering for the gospel and going through persecution. If trends continue, right, 4,000 people will probably die for their faith this year, for the Christian faith this year. Okay. To call offense persecution cheapens the sacrifice of others. So there's that distinction in it while we're talking about it. Jesus also said in there, so that you will be called sons of God. He's not saying that if you don't love your enemies, you're not my son. That's not what he's saying, or my child. John Piper says, loving your enemy doesn't pay for your birth into God's family. It just proves that you've been born into God's family. So I just want to make that clear. Okay. What does this actually look like? There isn't a caveat. He doesn't say, love them if, right? He says, God sends his rain and the sun on both the righteous and the unrighteous. God provides no matter what our response is. His response is constant and unconditional, regardless of our response to him. Here's two that I pulled up from them. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Great. That's easy. Keep doing it. But also, do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if we're really being called to be salt and light, that means that you stand out. Everyone loves people that loves them. That's no different from the world. And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? I say hi to people that I like in the grocery store. And if I don't like them, I might try to duck around the other way. He says, don't do that. Just because it would be awkward to talk to that person, don't pretend that they don't exist. They're still a human being. Do not even the Gentiles do the same. So here's the why. Because we are called to be salt and light. That's what he's been talking about the whole time. That's why we need to love our enemies, because it shows God's love. Here is a little bit more of a detailed list of what you can do for your enemy. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap burning coals upon his head. This doesn't mean to burn his head. It means in blessing. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Do not resist the evil person. There's a better way to do it. Don't retaliate with violence. Retaliate with love. I approach it in a kind of cavalier way, but I know that this is a hard concept. I would say that for many years, my sister was my enemy. My sister and I both dealt with our growing up trauma in two very different ways. I became prideful and arrogant. And my sister chose to numb the pain through drugs and alcohol and a lot of things that really hurt her. And rather than showing love, I did a lot of things that pushed her even farther away from God. I could have shown mercy when she begged for help, and I didn't. I told her it was what she deserved when she told me she was pregnant. It took years and years for us to reconcile, and God is so faithful. And she is a follower of his now, and it's not anything to do with me. It's just God chasing her down. But I think about all the pain that might have been avoided in her life. If I had reached out sooner and I had shown true love to her. And a lot of times we feel like, I just can't do it. I can't love that person that's hurt me so deeply. You can't. It starts with God. And if you can't start anywhere else, start with prayer. One story that I really love, Corrie Ten Boom, absolute hero of mine. Some years after the war, Corrie Ten Boom wrote a book, The Hiding Place, about her ordeal and how she battled with the bitterness and anger it caused. She developed a powerful speaking ministry and toured the world, preaching on how the power of God is able to turn the hatred of enemies into love. But it was not always easy. She wrote about a particular occasion when she came face to face with one of the former concentration camp guards. It was a church service in Munich that I saw him, the former SS man who stood guard at the shower room door in the processing center at Ravensbrück. He was the first of our actual jailers that I had seen since that time. And suddenly, it was there, the room full of mocking men, the heaps of clothing, Betsy's plain, blanched face. He came up to me as the church service was emptying, beaming and bowing. "How grateful I am for your message, Fräulein," he said, "to think that, as you say, Christ has washed my sins away." His hand was thrust out to shake mine, and I, who had preached so often to people in Blumenthal, the need to forgive kept my hand at my side. Even as the angry, vengeful thoughts broiled through me, I saw the sin of them. Jesus Christ had died for this man. Was I going to ask for more? "Lord Jesus," I prayed, "forgive me and help me to forgive him." I tried to smile, struggled to raise my hand. I could not. I felt nothing, not the slightest spark or warmth or charity. And so again, I breathed a silent prayer. "Jesus, I cannot forgive him. Give me your forgiveness." As I took his hand, the most incredible thing happened. From my shoulder along my arm and through my hand, a current seemed to pass from me to him. Well, into my heart sprang a love for this stranger that almost overwhelmed me. And so I discovered that it is not on our forgiveness that the world's healing hinges, any more than on our goodness, but on Christ's. When he tells us to love our enemies, he gives, along with the command, the very love itself. So if you can't do anything else, just start with prayer. Because if you're praying for someone, it's a lot harder to hate them when you're also asking God to bless them. So when we're wronged, what do? First, check your heart for anger like Sarah talked about. What's really going on inside of me? Is it another emotion? Is it a sin that I need to deal with first? Is it a feeling of offense that I need to let go? Do I need to go make things right? 2, check your motivation. Is it about you seeking retaliation or restoration? Here's the hard one that God brought to my life. No matter what another person has done to me, that person is still made in the image of God. No matter how much they have hurt me, that fact doesn't change. And I'm called to treat them with dignity, even if they don't do that to me. You have rights. We live in a country with so many rights. But you still get to choose how much of those rights you claim. Is there a way for justice to be served that would equally show God's love and end up drawing that enemy into a place of friendship with Christ? This is what he ends on. You, therefore, must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. But God demonstrates his own love for this. While we were his enemies, he died for us. His cheeks were slapped and bruised and beaten as he walked to the cross. He gave of himself. He gave his blood to cover us and his grace on top of that. He doesn't just walk 1 mile with us. He walks a whole lifetime. He gives to us generously whenever we beg, no matter how we have treated him. Our standard is not Gentiles or the people around us or the Jewish community. Our standard for love is God. God, these are hard words. These are words that are uncomfortable. These are words that might bring up hate and might cause us to say, but you don't really know my situation. God, I pray for authentic love to fill our hearts for those that are lost, that our desire would be to restore everyone, no matter what they have done, that we would act with wisdom as we seek justice, and that our actions would draw others towards you. May we seek to be like you, God. Give us the forgiveness we don't have. Give us the love we don't have. But above all, God, we thank you. We thank you that you love us so deeply that even while we were your enemies, even while we continue to sin and rebel against you and treat you with scorn and hate, it doesn't change your love for us, God, and we thank you that that is who you are. In your name, amen.